Q&A, and a digression. The fourth talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on October 25, 2015, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 4, Q&A, and a digression, accompanies this talk.
Okay, the plan is to continue in Exodus, but I want to take a little bit of time right at the beginning to respond to some questions that came up last week, and then I plan to open it up for questions that you may still have from last week or questions that you may have from before that as well. And then if there is time, then we'll go on in Exodus to the next section. The first question, three different people asked this question, so I'll answer it first, and that is, did the Egyptians look different from the Israelites? Could you tell by looking at someone whether they were an Egyptian or an Israelite? So I got online and found some images of Israelites and Hebrews. We have those. I'm not sure whether they're Israelites. They might be Western Semites, but it would be the same ethnic group. And that's in the handout that was sent out. So if you have it, you can look at that. If you don't have it, I'll try to describe it. The first image that we have is showing some Western Semites arriving in Egypt. And as I recall, this image dates back to about 1800 BC. So it's about the time of Abraham that this dates back to. And the thing that's interesting here is there are differences in appearance. The Egyptians wear their hair differently and they are clean shaven. And typically they wear a white skirt-like thing. The Semites, on the other hand, have these wraparound tunics that are very colorful, and they have full beards, and they have a different kind of hairdo, and you can look and see what that is. So they're most easily distinguished by the way they dress and the way they shave or don't shave themselves and their hairdo. But are there other characteristics that will tell you whether it's an Israelite or an Egyptian? And the first thing that one might think of is skin color. If you notice in the picture, the Egyptians are depicted as being dark-skinned, and the Israelites or the Western Semites, some of them are light-skinned and some of them are dark-skinned just like the Egyptians. So it looks like the Western Semites are mixed, and so there is not a one skin color that goes with them. And so if you want to look at this, you can look online. I've got the website address there. I just pulled these up. This first website looks a little weird, so I'm not advocating that you go and read what's on the website. That's just where I found this image. The second image I thought was particularly interesting, not so much for this particular question, but all of the scenes in this image have to do with making bricks. So it shows the various processes that are involved in making the bricks, mixing the mud, mixing straw into it, putting it into a mold, turning it out onto the ground to dry, those kinds of things. The top register is Egyptians doing that work. The bottom register is slaves doing that work, and presumably those are Western Semites that are doing that. This came from a different website that actually looks a little bit more interesting. The Egyptians are not of the same ethnic group as the Western Semites. They are not related as far as scholars can tell. The language that they spoke is completely different. It is not a Semitic language at all in Egypt. And it's not clear where the Egyptians originated. As far as I know, scholars say that as far as back as they can trace it, the Egyptians were in Egypt. The Western Semites, on the other hand, their homeland is in what is now Syria. And we know that they spread out from there. Many of them went from Syria, they went southeast into Mesopotamia because Sumer was located there, And so there were lots of job opportunities. And it's the same phenomenon that we see today. When Sumer became wealthy, Sumerians didn't want to do the drudgery labor. And so it was Semites who drifted in, and they did the drudgery labor. And some of them would then go back to Syria. They would move back and forth sometimes, but oftentimes they would become enculturated in Sumer, and then they would move just north of that area, and that became a Semitic state that eventually rivaled Sumer in power and eventually defeated Sumer. So an interesting feature of history that repeats itself, of groups moving into an area, becoming enculturated, and then having an impact on that area in one way or another. Another group of Semites then went from Syria to Canaan and became the Canaanites. So those are all related people groups. That's all Semitic, but the Egyptians are not. So if you were to walk into Egypt at this time, would you have been able to tell who is Israelite and who is Egyptian? You certainly could tell by their clothing and their hairdress and whether they're wearing a beard or not. But other than that, I don't know that you could. And we'll see soon in the narrative, Moses is going to run away from Egypt. He goes to Midian, and there he is taken to be an Egyptian. So it must be the case that if one is a Western Semite, it is not immediately obvious that that's the case. Okay. The next question, someone asked me about the dilemma that I described last week, and I'll describe it again, and maybe I can make it a little clearer. The dilemma that I face and that I was talking about is this situation in which I find myself frequently, and that is, I was raised with traditional values, and I'm thankful that I was raised with traditional values. But as time has gone on, I have looked at various of those values and have seen that there are ways in which I needed to moderate some of those, that they were not entirely in line with truth. So when I have concluded that that's the case, I have made those modifications in some of those values. But I'm aware that the culture that I am living in is sprinting away from traditional values and putting pressure on all of us to sprint away from traditional values. And I can feel that pressure, and I'm sure that you can all feel that pressure. And the question that is, when am I modifying my understanding of traditional values in a way that makes them conform closer to what is true? And when am I capitulating to the culture and telling myself that I'm making adjustments to those values that need to be made? I hope you understand the picture that I'm painting, and I suspect that many of you have experienced it. And I think it is a difficult dilemma that we're in, and sorting all of that out is not easy. I'll use the most obvious example, probably, and that is my view towards homosexuality. That the view that I adopted as a boy and as a young man was one in which homosexuality was the worst kind of sin that exists, and that any homosexual is a beast not worthy of our respect. I don't know if anybody told me that, but that's kind of what I absorbed. And as time has gone on, it has become clear to me that that cannot line up with truth. That cannot be the way that we are supposed to think about homosexuality. And so, as I've understood more about, there are lots of sins that we all commit. We're all sinners, and that is one variety of sin. And even if that sin does not place someone in another category, that makes them unworthy of our love and respect. And it's been a process understanding that and incorporating that in my thinking that I think has been a good process. It's a modification that needed to be made. But the pressure from the culture is, you need to go even further. It's not even a sin. There's nothing wrong with it. And that is, I feel that pressure. I suspect we all feel that pressure. And yet, I have looked at the arguments that have been made on the basis of the Bible, trying to justify homosexuality, and I don't see it. I just don't see it. So that's the kind of tension that I'm talking about, and that's what I was describing in my dilemma. Mm-hmm.
Doesn't God call it an abomination? He gives it a special sin?
Well, the word abomination is used, absolutely. I don't know that it's a special sin. That's a difficult thing to sort out, is are there special sins? How does one rank sins? And there are various bases on which one might rank sins. There's only one sin that really stands head and shoulders above any other, and that is cursing the Holy Spirit. Rejecting the Holy Spirit is the one that's singled out as being a particularly heinous sin, and that's worthy of damnation. But I'm not aware of any other sin that fits in that category. Okay, so that's the tension that I was trying to describe. The third question that was asked is, didn't the Egyptians view the Nile as a god? And couldn't it have been that the king asked the Egyptians to throw the Israelite babies into the Nile as kind of a religious act, like sacrificing those babies to the god of the Nile? And it is true. They did see the Nile as a god. Whether that was one of the justifications for that particular way of killing the Israelite children, I don't know. It's possible. But I am still convinced that one of the major considerations for the king was that he wanted to have the babies killed in the least socially disruptive way possible. And I think that's why he enlisted the midwives, that he wanted to do it clandestinely. He didn't want it to be a big deal and a traumatic kind of thing. Okay. The Egyptians had a lot of gods, and we'll be talking about that more when we come to the plagues. It is significant, the role that those gods play. Then the fourth question was, could Moses' mother have placed Moses in a basket and put him in the Nile in imitation of Noah? That could it be that the inspiration for Moses' mother's idea to hide Moses in a basket and stick him in the Nile River, could that possibly have come from the story of Noah? And I had thought about that. I don't know how well Moses' mother knew the events, the history of the world and the history of the Israelites, but it's possible that story was one that she would have heard and would have been aware of. It's possible that there would have been inspiration there for her to do that. The thing that is intriguing is that the word for ark, the ark that Noah built, is teva. And the only other context in which that word shows up is with respect to Moses' basket. So I think that we are intended to see some kind of association between those two things. Whether Moses' mother took inspiration from that or not, I don't know. But I am more confident that the author of Exodus wants to recall the event of the flood that Noah escaped in the ark, and that that bears some kind of similarity to Moses living through this event in Egyptian history by being placed in a basket and being placed in the water. And I think that those associations are very interesting, and we will see more of those, and we need to think about what value do those associations provide. If we go forward in time, rather than going back, we go back to Noah, but if we go forward, we can go to Jesus and the event in which Moses lives through the killing of the young boys in Egypt at the hands of the king, that bears some similarities with Jesus, who escapes the killing of the young boys at the hands of the king, this time Herod, and is taken away to safety. And I think there's something there for us to examine as well. And I've got in my notes, if you look at Revelation 12, 1 through 17, in that story of the dragon that's trying to kill the boy, that there are things there that hint back at Noah and potentially Moses. And I find all of those connections interesting. I'm not sure exactly what to do with those associations, but I think they're there and I think they're important. And that leads me into the digression that I've got in my outline. I was going to talk about this later, but I decided I'd at least get the discussion started now. But it's something that I want us all to be thinking about and trying to sort out and make good sense of. As I was teaching through Isaiah, one of the things that was a surprise to me to discover, and something that's been very significant in my thinking, is the way that Isaiah is presenting history, he's presenting things that are going to happen, and that do happen soon after Isaiah pronounces them, but they happen in a bigger and more significant sense much later in history. The first place that I saw that, and I've talked about this when I taught through Isaiah, but the story of Emmanuel, that it is predicted in chapter 7 of Isaiah that there will be a child born, he will be named Emmanuel. And before he gets to be a certain age, that the enemies of Judah will be defeated. And I was looking at that and looking at the fact that Matthew cites that with respect to the birth of Jesus, cites that passage, refers to it. And he is obviously seeing a correlation there. Well, if you look at the passage in Isaiah, I'm convinced that there is no way that that makes sense as a prediction of the birth of Jesus. However, there are some remarkable parallels between that event and the birth of Jesus. And as I am putting it together, it seems to me that the event of Emmanuel was a foreshadowing of the birth of Jesus. And I'm calling it foreshadowing because I don't think it's predictive. You couldn't read Isaiah 7 and say, oh, I know a young boy is going to be born in Bethlehem, et cetera, et cetera. There's no way you could do that, I don't think. But when Jesus is born, you can look back at Isaiah 7 and say, oh my goodness, something similar has happened before. There's some kind of association going on here. And I'm convinced that there is that kind of foreshadowing in the Old Testament that happens fairly often, that something foreshadows an event that is going to come at a much later date and usually is filled out in a way that's more profound and more significant. There are many parallels between the life of Moses and the ministry of Moses and the ministry of Jesus. Ron has pointed out some of those, and there are several of those that we can talk about. And I think, particularly in Matthew, he's highlighting that. That's important to him. Because Jesus is, in a sense, a new Moses. And I think that's what Matthew is wanting to communicate. Jesus is baptized, and his baptism is kind of like going through the Red Sea. And right after he's baptized, he goes out into the wilderness. And that's kind of like going into the wilderness. The Israelites going into the wilderness and being there for 40 years. Jesus is in the wilderness for 40 days. Big difference is the Israelites blew it in the wilderness, and Jesus doesn't. So there's an association with a significant difference that's worthy of note. And we could go on. There are a number of things that I think are foreshadowed in the Old Testament, in particular the Torah, for the first five books of the Old Testament. And then those are a similar thing happens in a more profound sense later on. There's another phenomenon in the Old Testament that, and I've come up with this term, I don't know that anybody else uses this term. Somebody has probably come up with a better term for it, but I call it a historical metaphor. And a historical metaphor is when, you know what a metaphor is? A metaphor is an analogy that, I'm not going to be able to come up with a good one right off the bat. You all know what a metaphor is. It's an analogy. It's where two things bear something in common, and then you can reflect on the fact that they have that one thing in common. God, as the author of history, is in a unique position that he can shape history in such a way that the events of history become little pictures, and they can picture spiritual truths. They can become metaphors for understanding spiritual truths. I am convinced that the prime example, the prime metaphor for salvation is God bringing the Israelites out of Egypt. That is a picture of salvation that we can take then. And when in the New Testament, either the gospel writers or Paul are talking about salvation, the picture that can come to mind is God bringing the Israelites out of Egypt. That's the metaphor then for salvation, for a spiritual truth. And I'm convinced there are a lot of those historical metaphors that God has created in history that he can then draw upon to make clearer the spiritual truths that he wants to teach to us. I just got a couple here. I mentioned Exodus and salvation. Manna becomes a physical metaphor then for God's gracious provision. The Passover, when God kills all of the firstborn, but he does not kill the firstborn of those households where they did what God told them to do, to kill a lamb and put the blood on the doorposts. The Passover then becomes a metaphor, a historical metaphor for understanding Jesus' atonement for our sins, and etc. There are others that we could talk about. So the way I'm seeing it now, and this has been since I went through Isaiah, this has become more clear to me, that the Old Testament is this storehouse of associations and metaphors that are there to be drawn upon by later authors of books of the Bible to make their point in a way that we can relate it back to what happened in the Old Testament, and it becomes clearer. Okay, so that's why, in my mind, understanding the Old Testament, in particular the Torah, is so foundational. It's like the vocabulary, it's like the lexicon for the rest of the Bible that's drawn upon by the biblical authors to make the points that they want to make. Okay, so that's what I was going to say with respect to last week. I'm going to open it up for questions. Maybe there aren't any questions, but if there are, please ask them, and then we'll see where we are.
I wanted to know if you have a guess. You mentioned that there were stories from maybe Mesopotamia about kings who were hidden in baskets in the river and survived. Would Moses' mom, would the Western Semites in that area have had access to that story, the way like we know Cinderella or Little Red Riding Hood, that kind of thing?
I think that the answer to that is yes, because certainly if we look at Sargon, which is, as far as I know, that's the oldest of those stories, it dates back to about 2200 BC, so many centuries before Moses. And we know that that story was widespread within Mesopotamia. And it is becoming clearer and clearer that the amount of cultural transformation, cultural interchange between Mesopotamia and Egypt was much greater than they used to think. I know when I read books in the 70s about ancient Egypt, most scholars thought that ancient Egypt was culturally isolated from what was happening in Mesopotamia. But there have been a number of finds since then that indicate that that's not at all the case. There was cultural interchange between them. And in particular, there would have been cultural interchange between Canaan and Egypt. And Canaan had a lot of cultural ties going back to Mesopotamia because of that phenomenon that I was talking about that Abraham fits into. So I think the answer to that certainly has to be yes, they would have known such stories.
I love that then, because you can see that in the light of don't accept apples from strangers. They could be poisoned. Don't fall for a wolf in sheep's clothing. There's these kinds of things that we know because of the stories that we grew up with.
Right, right.
So then, well, let's put the baby in the river. Maybe that'll turn out well. Turned out well in the story.
Right. What you're suggesting is maybe the inspiration for what she did came not from Genesis, but came from these other stories, and that's possible.
Quick question and then an observation, if you will, about king becoming pharaoh. There's no timeline on this.
Right.
So we have this, we interpolate, I guess, but is it possible that the king became pharaoh or that the pharaoh is a different person than the king? My question is based around the idea that the pharaoh was the son of God. King may have just been king. Now, if the king adopted the religion and became pharaoh, then we see the transition in the text. Or if the king died and the next guy went full bore into the religion, we see a change in the whole political, religious dynamic ruling the land.
I'd be surprised. I'm reluctant to say no, because I don't know. But I'd be surprised. I traced through how Pharaoh is used in all of Exodus. And it's only in the first two chapters that he is referred to as the king. Sometimes it will be, it changes. There's one or two times when it's king of Egypt. Sometimes then after that, then it is typically Pharaoh, and sometimes Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. But it's only in those first two chapters that king is used, and it's possible, but I suspect that the author is using the word king because he wants to highlight some aspect of his office other than his Egyptianness. But that's all the further I've gotten.
And the observation is that he's a bit of a monster.
Mm-hmm.
He's a mobster, cold-hearted SOB of a guy to order these children to be slaughtered. And that's typical when you're telling the story of your history, the bad guys are monsters. But they portrayed this daughter of the Pharaoh as a rescuer. She is a good person and does a great thing. And through the narrative, Pharaoh remains a monster, but they don't really talk about individual Egyptians being evil. And so it, in that way, it does not resemble many of the stories you read about how we survived or overcame or threw off or overthrew our oppressors. And boy, they were monsters. It's really missing in the narrative.
My reading of it would be that there's a sense in which he's a monster and there's a sense in which he's not. The sense in which he's not is what he's doing makes a lot of sense. That if you have someone who, as I understand it, he has just come to power and he needs to solidify his position. Well, what's he going to do? Well, he's going to do what other kings have done. That is, you need some victories. You need to be able to show your power. You need to be able to develop wealth, build impressive buildings, those kinds of things. Well, that's the direction that he is going. And he's doing it on the manpower of a social group that he can take advantage of, that's in their midst. That is, there's a sense in which that's monster-like, but there's another sense in which he's just doing what human beings do. He's a monster like Hitler was a monster. On the one hand, absolutely he was a monster, but on the other hand, he was doing what people in power do, and something that we're all capable of doing. And he's not fully aware of the significance of what he's doing. And he gets started down a path that makes things trickier. So he has to come up with more drastic solutions. And it just spins out of control on him.
So on that note, why do you think the Pharaoh would have let his daughter adopt Moses?
Yeah.
That makes no sense.
It makes no sense. No, it makes no sense. That's interesting. I suspect that the daughter's argument is, it's only one child. Because the Pharaoh's looking for numbers. That's what he's concerned about. And my suspicion is that she says, and he's so cute, and there's just one of him, and can't I keep him? It's like bringing a puppy home or something. But I don't know. And I don't know, it would be interesting to know more about that daughter. What is her character? Is she just seeing this as a puppy, or is there something more significant going on there?
Well, and that he could have just stayed as kind of her servant, but he actually gets promoted in power. Mm-hmm. So that makes no sense either.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why would the Pharaoh allow his daughter to adopt this Hebrew and then allow him to raise up in power?
Right. But one of the things that's observable here, and I've noticed it in Genesis as well, that as people set out on a course of rebellion, they do more and more things that make no sense. And I think that's part of what's happening here. Things kind of spin out of control on Pharaoh. And so he does things that kind of that don't make sense fully. And how he responds to his daughter, I think, fits into that category. It doesn't fit with what he wants to do. It is interesting.
Is there any evidence that Moses grew up with the son of Pharaoh that then was the Pharaoh that Moses dealt with later? Is he actually dealing with somebody that was like a brother to him?
I'll talk about that when we start in the next passage. The short answer is yes.
I had a thought about him letting the daughter keep Moses and stuff. It seems like what's motivating Pharaoh is not so much a hatred of the Hebrews as a group, but a fear of what they might do if their numbers overwhelm that of the Egyptians.
Yeah.
So his first solution to just kill some babies for a while kind of would take care of that in the future. And there's no indication of how long that's supposed to go on.
Right.
And then having his people kill the babies is more drastic and does kind of make less sense in a way as like it seems like just a last-ditch effort mm-hmm. to make that plan work. And so I could see one baby who's going to be raised with a something of a debt to the Pharaoh's family mm-hmm. being like, that doesn't constitute the same kind of threat mm-hmm. as lots of Hebrews who feel no loyalty to Egypt and are just going to join Egypt's enemies. It almost seems like it could fit with Pharaoh's long-term goals as far as like having groups that are loyal to him. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's kind of weird. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is probably a bizarre one, but you mentioned that the midwives lied and that some commentaries don't believe that they lied, that they told the truth, that the babies were being born before they got there. And then you talked about a lie, an untruth, and bearing false witness, and that in some cases where the obvious meaning, like your destruction or something, was the solution to whatever is being required of you, if you disobey or do the wrong thing, that you knew you were going to die or the person was going to die. The question is, in some cases like today, where some of these kids that are in schools that have these incidents of shootings, and the kids are basically being terrorized by an individual who is posing a question to them about their faith, and they know in their mind that if they answer yes, they'll be shot. If they answer no, who knows what would happen? Mm-hmm. Is this in your mind? If you don't have an answer for this, that's fine too, mm-hmm. because I don't have an answer for it. Is this something that would fall into that category of what you were telling us last week?
Mm-hmm. Does it fall in the category of situations where it's difficult to know what to do? Yes. But what should one do in that kind of situation? And I don't know the answer to that. But it seems to me, one of the situations that I posed last week is one that's been kicked around a lot, and that is a Nazi comes to the door and asks if you have any Jews that you're hiding in your house. I would feel more comfortable lying under those circumstances than if the Nazi came up, say I'm Jewish, and the Nazi comes and says, are you Jewish? Because in one case, it's somebody else's fate that I have in my hands. In the other case, it's my own fate that I have in my hands. And so if I decide to take the stand for what I believe, that's on me. It's not on anybody else. And in that case, I think that it is probably one should take that kind of stand. But I don't know the answer to those kinds of questions. I think those are very difficult. And one thing that I've noticed in our culture, as time has gone on, we take oaths and promises and truth-telling less seriously, it seems to me. Let me give one example. What about a prisoner in war? When I was young, for a prisoner of war to divulge any information was seen to be treasonous. Now, it seems to me, the way we think about it is that person should tell him whatever they need to tell them in order to avoid the torture and whatever. You divulge information, even if they lie about it, but give them information so you don't get tortured. Well, it seems to me there's a shift. I mean, am I right? Has there been a shift there? It seems to me that there has been that shift. And I'm not sure what to do with that. I'm reluctant to get too permissive with respect to telling untruths. I think the line needs to be drawn way over in the direction of not lying, but I do think that there are those circumstances where it's justifiable. But where you draw that line, I don't really know.
I was thinking that in a situation like Germany is a country and it's being ruled by this person, so there's this authority.
Yeah.
And even though they're doing something evil, it is almost not determined to be a evil thing because it's coming from this place of authority.
Right.
Whereas here's a kid who's doing something completely illegal.
Right.
It's criminal.
Right.
And so,
right.
And who are you answering to when you give him an answer? There's the conscience and there's the whole theory behind mm-hmm. what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
In so many senses, you can't even imagine being in that situation.
Right.
So it is very difficult.
Right, right.
you and, for but, your study.
But in that situation in Germany, it gets even more complicated when we have a situation in which it is power that is, I would say, not lawful. There were laws that were used to justify what they were doing, but it's not lawful in the sense of they have abandoned a situation in which there is rule of law. Laws are just this smokescreen that are used to allow them to do what they want to do. And I think it is possible for a government to become an outlaw government and not worthy of our obedience. But where do you draw that line? And I don't know the answer to that one either.
Mm-hmm. I have an easier question, I think. My question was, is it at all possible that Pharaoh didn't know Moses was Hebrew when he came to his house? Because I was just reading over it, and it doesn't say mm-hmm. anywhere mm-hmm. that he knew. And there were those that thought he was Egyptian, obviously, and later on. Mm-hmm. But is it possible that he was raised as just an abandoned child in the Pharaoh's home, as the Pharaoh's daughter's child?
It's possible. These narratives don't give us a lot of information, so you can go in different directions. But I think it more probable that the Pharaoh would have known that he was an Israelite. And I'll describe that in a little bit here, how I'm putting the pieces together. But could I preclude the possibility that the Pharaoh didn't know? No, I can't preclude that possibility.
I think it's kind of interesting the way when they discover Moses in the basket, that the daughter's been watching and kind of jumps up and says, "Hey, I know a lady that can help you out. Feed that baby." And I wondered if it was possible that Moses' family or the Levites knew that that's where the Pharaoh's daughter would come.
There are some commentators that think that that's the scenario that's being described, that they hypothesized that she bathed at the same place on certain days, and so the basket was intentionally placed there where Pharaoh's daughter would see it, and they had some reason to think that she would respond positively to it. If they didn't know that, she'd just take it and dump Moses out into the river. So presumably they had some reason to think that she would respond positively. And that's a possible scenario.
I just happened to be reading a story set many, many years later than when we're talking about, but it has some interesting parallels as you're talking about Moses. Mm-hmm. One of them, it's set in the time of Augustus Caesar in the Roman Empire. And it helped to explain a couple of things. One, about the question that came up about how did Moses rise to such an important position? It's not unusual, it seems, at all. Augustus Caesar, one of his most trusted advisors, had risen from being a Greek slave to being the top advisor to Caesar. And that, apparently, according to this historian, was not that unusual, because when a people were conquered, one of the things that the new rulers tended to look for was who were the best and the brightest. And they had no problem whatsoever when they found them in giving them important positions, because they wanted to use mm-hmm. their education and their brightness. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the Romans, who had not emphasized studying and literature and things as much as the Greeks had, they were sharp enough to figure out these guys made real good advisors. Because often they were better read and understood the world better than some of the Romans mm-hmm. did. So that's very much like Moses mm-hmm. being elevated. The other thing that seemed to be a parallel was, in that story, is the name. Somebody was asking about the interchangeableness of king and pharaoh. Well, by the time the Romans come along, it's fascinating to see the interchanging of names, because Caesar was the actual official title of the guy who ruled everything. And in their language, it really was pretty parallel to king. However, that particular leader at that time was also called Augustus, because that was his private name to go with Caesar. He was Augustus Caesar, not Julius or some mm-hmm. of the other ones. But the man who actually was born and then became Augustus Caesar was Marcus Aurelius. So you can have a person named Marcus Aurelius who takes on the name of Augustus and is the Caesar. Mm-hmm. Well, it shows you that, again, it's not that unusual that a couple of titles may have been applied interchangeably to the king of Egypt. Mm-hmm. And it keeps on happening as you go on through history, it seems. The other question, a whole bunch of them that we covered today, you have to, with this question of truth-telling, and we're going to kick that one around till the Lord comes back, because there's so many, and none of us know what we would do if we had been in that room down at Umpqua Community College. You don't know until you're there.
Right.
Are you going to answer the question or not? But I think we can ask ourselves ahead of time, isn't there a difference between being, for instance, in a courtroom or some such situation where we've witnessed something and we're being asked to tell the truth about what we saw? And if we don't do that, we are definitely bearing false witness. What does God require of us, we have to, I think, ask ourselves, when it comes to giving an honest answer to a psychopathic madman who asked me a question? And I have trouble picturing that if in that situation, to save myself or my family members or other people in that room, I don't give him an honest answer, I don't think that I'm going to be held responsible for that because of who that guy is and whether or not he has a right to ask me a question and expect my honest answer, mm-hmm. even unto death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a difficult question, I think. Anything else? There are just a few minutes left. Let me just talk about Moses' education, because that question came up. We know historically that Egypt, at this particular point in time, so we're talking about whether you take the early date for the Exodus or you take the late date for the Exodus, both periods of time and in between, Egypt is extremely concerned about what's happening in Canaan, because they know that any major threat to Egypt is going to come through that corridor. Come through Palestine. As a result, the strategy that the Egyptians developed, and in Canaan at this time, there are a whole bunch of city-states. They are not organized into a kingdom. It's a whole bunch of little city-states. So each city has its own king, and they fought among themselves most of the time. They were rarely united. Egypt took advantage of that, and they would interfere with affairs in Canaan and encourage fighting when it was to Egypt's advantage to do so, and come in and play the peacemaker when it was in their advantage to do that. But they would kind of play with them to keep them from uniting and becoming a threat, and to be involved in that area so that they would know whether there were any threats coming from further east. As a result, what they did is they would take the princes from the various city-states in Canaan and take them to Egypt to educate them. It's a ploy that's been done other times in history where they're essentially taking them hostage. The kings, their fathers in Canaan, know that if they, the king, gets out of line, then they're putting their son in jeopardy in Egypt. But it's all under the guise of educating them. So in the Pharaoh's household, there was this school for these princes from Canaan in which the Pharaoh's children and other high-ranking officials' children were all being educated together. And the nature of the education, and apparently scholars know quite a bit about the education that was provided. Goran Larson has written a commentary on Exodus, and he has done a study of what we know about the curriculum that was used in these schools. And this is from Philip Ryken's commentary. He says, and this is a comment about Moses, but it's derived from what we know about that education. What is surprising about Moses' deep sympathy for those who suffered oppression is that he had been raised to show utter contempt for slaves. One of the primary goals of Pharaoh's educational system was to reinforce the pride of those in power. After reviewing the ancient Egyptian curriculum, Goran Larson notes, among these documents, one category of educational materials is particularly conspicuous, namely, texts that express a deep contempt of manual labor while stressing the value of study. Studies lead to a life far away from dust, dirt, and toil under harsh taskmasters. These texts emphasize the extremely low status of the working class in ancient Egyptian society. So he's pointing out how this education would have shaped Moses' thinking and his values. But the nature of the education was to study the literature and the culture of Egypt and of Canaan, and to learn how one rules a country wisely, as well as just absorbing all of the culture and the language of the area. And so that's the education that Moses would have received. Now, we don't know what position Moses held, if he held any positions in the government. We don't know what he... There are rabbinical tales about things that he did and accomplishments that he made, but those are probably all very late stories and are probably not reliable. So we don't know what Moses did during those first 40 years of his life, what things he might have accomplished, etc., etc. We just don't know. But we can assume that he received this kind of education, which would have been a thorough education, the best education possible at the time, and it included learning about the literature and the culture of Canaan, which is very interesting, because for him, that's home. Okay, well, let's stop there, and I'll begin next week with Exodus chapter 2, verse 11.